I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity. And I was probably looking at giving a very different talk, but conversations with Doug Scalapino over the last 3 weeks have sort of morphed this talk into what it is. So I don't know, I should give Doug the credit for it and take the blame for all the problems that are there in the talk. I see that there are a few ADS-CFT people. There'll be very little field theory in this talk. There may be one slide which tries to make some connections to ADS. Okay, very good. So this is the question that Mac and Doug asked us at the beginning of our program. So when and why do we get high transition temperatures? Can there be any lessons for material science? I have very few lessons for material science, but at least what I will do today is present some calculations in certain models where we look at superconductivity beyond BCS beam field theory, and we do these calculations as best as we can, and we compare with experiments, so we do have that as our guide. And we calculate quantities like the transition temperature, the energy gap, the superfluid stiffness, which give us some idea of when and why superconductivity is robust in these systems. And at various other points, I will also talk about other measures of robustness, such as the critical velocity or disorder effects in the superconducting state. So the two systems that I will focus on are two that I have worked on for, I don't know, past two decades in one form or another. But the reason for focusing on them other than that is that actually in some real sense, these are the highest transition temperature superconductors known in the lab. Maybe in neutron stars, there may or may not be superfluidity of other kinds. Okay. So one is the cold Fermi gases with the interaction tuned by a Feshbach resonance. And this has the highest known ratio of TC to epsilon Fermi, which is around 0.2. And the other is high temperature superconductivity in the cuprates, which has the highest transition temperature that we know in Kelvin. So let's first talk about the Fermi gas. And let me see if I can get a pointer. It doesn't matter. I'll use one of these. Here it is. Thank you. Good. So the experiments are on atomic gases. So whenever you get an even number here, you can convince yourself that you get a fermion. So lithium-7 is a boson, for instance. So lithium-6 and potassium-40. Because of 50 years of the history of BCS theory, everyone, including the atomic physicists, call the two species of fermions up and down spins, even though these are not really up and down spins. They are, in fact, two different hyperfine states. And the pairing of these spin-up and spin-down fermions is tuned, the interaction, via a trick in atomic physics called the Feshbach resonance, about which I will say very little, because it will take us afield. The only thing I want to say there is that when you're working in a situation of what is called a wide resonance, that is the resonance width much larger than the Fermi energy of the system, then for all intents and purposes, you can just discuss the problem as if it's a simple two-body scattering in a dilute gas, which is described by an S-wave scattering length. If those words don't make a lot of sense, I will say a little more about that. So there are at least six groups which have done pioneering work. The BCS-BC crossover was first observed by Debbie Jin and Jilla and Wolfgang Kettle at MIT. And here are some typical numbers. Unlike the solid state, they don't have 10 to the 23 fermions, but they have a million, 10 million fermions. Although TC over epsilon Fermi is large, TC in real units is quite small because epsilon Fermi is 100 nanokelvin to 1 microkelvin, and they go down to temperatures of order of maybe 0.05 or 0.1 epsilon Fermi. Okay, so here's the Hamiltonian density. So you have fermions with two species, sigma up and sigma down. They just have a simple non-relativistic dispersion. The chemical potential tunes the density. And KF inverse is then the intraparticle spacing, or KF is the Fermi wave vector. And there's an attractive interaction. So it's a very short-range attraction. So we are looking at a dilute gas where the range of the attraction is much, much smaller than the intraparticle spacing. So that's the small parameter. Okay, and the low energy effective interaction actually needs some regularization, because this is a delta function potential which is kind of sick, so you put some cutoff and you play some standard games and finally express everything in terms of the S wave scattering length, so you have a single dimensionless coupling constant 1 over KFAS. So here's some, just to give you a feel for what AS is, the scattering length, here's the two-body problem in vacuum, which is actually one particle quantum mechanics. And if you have a weakly attractive potential which is not able to bind a two-body bound state in vacuum in three dimensions, then you are in a regime where the scattering length is negative. As you increase the attraction, eventually reach the threshold for two-body bound state formation. Okay? And at that threshold, the scattering length goes to negative infinity. Once you have formed a two-body bound state in vacuum, the scattering length is no more, no less than the size of this pair. So on this side of the resonance, it's infinity. And as you crank up the attraction further, the scattering length falls further. So basically, the scattering amplitude is completely specified by the scattering length. And this point, the threshold for the formation of two-body bound state in vacuum, where AS diverges, is called unitarity, because then the scattering cross-section is unitarity limited, 4 pi over k squared. Yes?
Question. Yeah. What does the dashed line for AS less than 0 signify?
Actually, in this particular model, nothing. Okay? Yeah, but in the two-channel model, it does signify something. It's just a pictorial way of showing a bound state is about to form. But other than that, it doesn't have any. Okay, so what happens when you turn on such an interaction in the many-body problem? And this was a... there's been some old pioneering work of Tony Leggett, Philippe Nozias, and Stefan Schmetterling on that. So now we have this single axis 1 over KFAS. So if you are down here, you can't form two-body bound states in vacuum, but in the many-body system, you form this collective Cooper pairs, which are gigantic, much larger than the intraparticle spacing, and you eventually get a weakly interacting Fermi superfluid, which is the BCS state, which we know and love for more than 50 years. On the other hand, if you have very tightly bound pairs in vacuum, then you basically form composite bosons, and the ground state of the system is that the composite bosons condense. So even though the interaction between the fermions is very strong, at the end of the day, you get a very weakly interacting Bose superfluid, where the size of this diatomic molecule is much less than the intraparticle space. And in between lies this sort of no man's land, where very interesting things happen, okay, where you get pairs whose size is comparable to their intraparticle spacing, and you really get a genuinely strongly interacting superfluid where the interactions are only unitary limited. And this is an interesting point, AS equals infinity, because there's only a single length scale in the problem, KF inverse. Even though it's very strongly interacting, the interactions do not bring in either a length scale or an energy scale. Okay, so because this is a point that will become relevant later on in the talk, although right now it may seem slightly unmotivated, let me discuss the calculation of the correlation length versus pair size. Because in BCS theory, one is used to thinking of these two things as being one and the same. But in this problem, they are not. Okay, so if you calculate the size of the pair, then it's no surprise that going from BCS to BEC, it's this dashed curve which is monotonically decreasing, plotted on a log scale. So in the BCS limit, it's exponentially large. In the BEC limit, it's actually very, very tiny, as you can see. Make it as small as you want. On the other hand, if you look at certain other definitions of the correlation length, and we could get into how one would define it, but one possibility is look at the prefactor of the Ginzburg-Landau coherence length, the one which is going to diverge when you approach the transition. Okay? Or you could actually do some physical calculation where you perturb the order parameter and ask how it's going to heal. And what you find there is that that length, although essentially same up to some trivial factor in the BCS limit, has a quite different behavior. In fact, it becomes a minimum of order the interparticle spacing, which is all that it could do at unitarity since there's no other scale, but then rises again like a power law. Okay, that's because in a dilute Bose gas, in a dense Bose gas like helium-4, it's the intraparticle spacing which is the healing length. But in a dilute Bose gas, the diluteness parameter makes the healing length very large. Okay, so it's a very non-monotonic function through the crossover. So what do we know about the phase diagram of this problem as a function of temperature and interaction? Well, if you just do some kind of a saddle point approximation to a functional integral in a calculation using the Hamiltonian that I'd written down earlier, you actually find that there is a line which I've denoted T star. And the physical meaning of this line is that above T star and to the left of it, the system can be basically described in terms of fermionic degrees of freedom. Okay? In the BCS limit, this T star has the famous essential singularity. But when you go through unitarity and to the BEC side, in fact, T star is related to what is actually called Saha ionization, because you're really asking, when does a pair break up into its constituents? The energy scale for that is given by the binding energy of the pair, because you're forming two body bound states in vacuum. And this log comes from the fact that entropy favors broken pairs rather than bound pairs. Okay? So actually, this has nothing to do with the transition temperature. It's merely the pair formation temperature, which is a sort of crossover in the problem. Then when you do a one loop calculation around that, okay, what you find is a curve for TC. Okay. And that curve for TC seems to go to the right value for the non-interacting Bose-Einstein condensation temperature. So as you come out of the BCS limit, pair formation and pair condensation or phase coherence have split apart. Okay? And so this calculation was done in ancient times. But the thing to emphasize here is that if you look at two scales in the superfluid state, the pairing gap, even at zero temperature, it tracks the T star line. On the other hand, then you ask, if the pairing scale is going off to infinity, how come TC is so much lower than that? And you discover, if you calculate the superfluid density at zero temperature, and you actually don't even have to calculate it because this is a Galilean invariant system, so you know it's the full density. So the superfluid density gives a stiffness scale which is constant across this. It seems like whichever is the lower of the two is setting the scale for the phase transition. Okay, now if this was all theory, it perhaps would be less interesting. So there are real experiments. Here is an early interpretation of the data of Jin and Ketterly's group in terms of this calculation, which was done a decade before the experiments were done. And here is Matthias Troyer's best quantum Monte Carlo data, which shows, again, that like that calculation, which was just a one loop calculation giving you numbers of order 0.2 epsilon Fermi, he finds that at unitarity, the best estimate is 0.15, and then it goes up, in fact, a little bit to the BEC side of unitarity, and the maximum TC that they have reported is about a quarter of the Fermi energy.
That's an excellent
feedback. So the thing is, there is a maximum, and the reason we know there is a maximum is there's been an old question of what happens to the condensation temperature of a dilute Bose gas when you turn on interactions. And there are as many wrong papers on this as you would care to know. I mean, all the standard books also have wrong things on this. Okay, and the problem was finally settled by Gordon Baim and Frank Lalo and others only in the last 5 years, surprisingly, even for a dilute Bose gas. And the answer is that TC goes up when you turn on repulsive interactions in a dilute Bose gas. So that tells you that it must go up.
interaction is attractive on all?
The interaction is always attractive. So in fact, it's very weakly attractive. It's sufficiently attractive that even in the two-body problem in vacuum, you would get the bound state. And here it's so attractive that you get very tightly bound molecular bosons.
It's all normal S-wave pairing.
Normal?
All S-wave pairing.
Yes, because it's an on-site. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I will emphasize these points. Okay, another beautiful observation in the experimental world is of vortices, and here you see the Abrikosov lattice in a rotating BCS-BEC crossover. This is work of Martins Wehrlein and Ketterly at MIT. So this started us looking at vortices, and I'm not going to tell you anything about all the many things we calculated about vortices, except we learned something about the critical velocity. So forget all these equations. Okay, just look at this picture. If you look at the flow of current around a vortex, then the single vortex has its core at zero. Out at infinity, you get 1 over r superflow. That's just very easy to see. It's just gradient of phi gives you that. Okay, but when the flow velocity becomes too large, the system says, I can't take it anymore, and the order parameter collapses in the center of the vortex. And so you get rigid body-like rotation, meaning currents proportional to r at the center of the vortex. And so this flow pattern gives you at least one way of figuring out what the critical current or the velocity in the system is. At least it's one way of looking at it. And a few years ago, we found that when we calculated this, it had a very strongly peaked maximum at or perhaps near unitarity. That's the best we could say. Okay, so this is the maximum in PC, even if it exists, is a fairly weak phenomenon. Here we found something which was very strongly non-monotonic. So we wanted to understand, why is that? And so you can do a very simple Landau criterion analysis of that. So ask for what excitations make superflow unstable. Okay. And so Landau taught us that you should look at the minimum of the excitation energy versus K. And the physical picture that emerges is the following. In the BCS limit, if you push on the superfluid, eventually the pairs break apart. So that's pair breaking. So the gap sets the scale for that. And that scale would have gone up. However, on the BEC side, something else is much more important. If you push on the superfluid, it can spew out collective excitations. Okay? And here, you have a neutral superfluid. So you have a phonon branch, the Goldstone mode of the broken U1, in fact. Okay? And because this is a gas and not a liquid, there is no roton, unlike in the helium-4 story. So basically, all you need to get to calculate is the speed of sound, which goes from a famous 1 over square root 3 here, Anderson and Bogeborg before I was born, crossing over into the dilute Bose gas. Okay? And so whichever is the smaller of the two is going to determine the critical velocity. And again, what's nice about this field is we predicted this, and a year later, Ketterly's group saw the non-monotonic critical velocity through the BCS BEC crossover. Yes? It is not clear, but every calculation that anybody has done has not given it, and we rationalize it in the following way. If you think about Feynman's variational wave function way of thinking about rotons, then the roton minimum comes because of a peak in the structure factor, the static structure factor, which is in the denominator of Feynman's result. And that is a very liquid-like phenomena. This being a gas, even though it's very strongly interacting, doesn't have such a peak. You're absolutely right. Okay, so this is a very Prosopovsky's question is very well taken. If you had asked me before the experiment whether the experiment and the prediction would come out right on top of each other, I would have said quite likely not, because in helium-3, in fact, the roton gives an answer which is orders of magnitude worse. Except when you have ions moving in helium-4, when you have ions moving in helium-4, you actually do get the rotor story. But if you flow through a constriction, then you generate vortices. So I think how exactly the specific geometry and the conditions in which you measure the critical velocity and expense is very important. And maybe we just lucked out.
Like helium in very thin film section or very thin capillary.
Yeah.
That's actually also rotons.
Yeah.
What is not doesn't you?
That's correct. So we can I can discuss with you exactly the experiment that Catalyst group did.
So how do you distinguish liquid and gas?
Say again?
How do you distinguish liquid and gas?
Liquid is one which holds its shape. Here, if you turn off the trap, everything flies away. Okay. So this is the one slide which tries to make connections with ABS CFD. So if you look at the unitary Fermi gas, as I said, the scattering length goes to infinity. And there's only a single length scale, which is the intraparticle spacing. So if I were to actually look at the unitary Fermi gas at zero chemical potential and zero temperature, zero chemical potential means you've actually even taken away all the particles. I mean, negative chemical potentials mean you have no particles. And I should tell the high-energy theorists that unlike relativistic quantum field theories like QCD, if you take it to zero chemical potential, it's still a highly non-trivial theory because of pair creation and so on, quantum fluctuations. Here, actually, if you go to negative chemical potential, it becomes there's nothing, literally nothing. Okay, so be that as it may, if you take it to zero temperature and zero chemical potential, there's absolutely no length scale in the problem. And Sachdev and Nicolette said that you could look at this as a quantum critical point, and they used an SP2N theory in the large N limit to study some properties of it and so on. And Dan Son, who is here for this program, actually he has written some very intriguing papers about this point actually being a non-relativistic conformal field theory, and perhaps there being a gravity dual of that. And I actually don't know what the most recent progress on understanding the physics of this problem from this perspective is. There is a phase transition in the same sense. Suppose I take the non-interacting Fermi gas, okay, at zero temperature, okay, and I change chemical potential. Then for negative chemical potential, I have nothing. And for positive chemical potential, I have something. And the way the density of particles turns on as a function of mu has a singularity. We all know what that is, some 3/2 power or something like that. So there is a singularity. Now, whether this is whether this is useful or not may depend on your perspective. So actually, you can look at an entire chapter in Subir Sachdev's book, where he tries to make the case that these nothing to something transitions are actually useful to look at from the point of view of
quantum. But is this the same thing as A equal to zero? Or
no.
No.
I gave you a trivial example just to make my point. Here, the AS equals infinity point is a very complicated story. As soon as you have something, when you have nothing, you have nothing.
So the question is, what happens when you enter the first particle?
Sure.
On one side, the first particle you enter is a fermion, and on the other side, the first particle which you enter is a
boson.
It's two particles in your boson.
Yeah.
And that's the multi-critical point where you go from the critical point where the first particle you enter is a fermion to the first particle which you enter is a boson.
Okay. So the first thing is, since a lot of my colleagues in this room are actually solid-state physicists, they say, okay, this is all nice stuff in gases, but is there anything we can learn from that, okay? So there are some very serious differences with solid-state systems. Okay, so unlike solid-state systems, you have a strongly attractive, instantaneous, short-range interaction. This virtually never happens in the solid state, okay? And this leads, as I'd already answered the question to, I think, Professor Chomsky, you just have S-wave pairing and nothing else. And there's no long-range Coulomb interaction to contend with. Okay. The other thing is that because this is a diluted gas, the effective interaction between particles is pretty much the same as the bare interaction. So I can say a little bit more about that. But basically, diagrammatically, you know, every time you make up, you need to have some particle hole dressings of the effective interaction. Every time you add a whole line that's suppressed in a low density system. Okay, this system is Galilean invariant. That gave you some specific things. It had no competing phases whatsoever. There was some quantum critical point nearby, but I think the flavor of that quantum critical point is completely different from the ones that we see in solid state systems where you might see superconductivity in inclusivities. However, there are some lessons, okay? So I think the first one is a psychological one, that you can have TC over epsilon Fermi, which is of order 0.2. Okay, because people used to write down theorems saying no more than 30 Kelvin or something, you know. That just isn't true. It's been observed in the lab. Okay? The other lesson is that the maximum transition temperature occurs in the crossover regime between where on one side of it, pair breaking destroys superfluidity, and on the other side, phase fluctuations. Okay, and even more so in this Galilean invariant problem than TC, this is seen in the case of this critical velocity, as I showed. Okay, the other lesson is that the maximum TC seems to be occurring in the same region in which you have a minimum coherence length, not necessarily a minimum pair size. Okay, and finally, at least in this simple model, you have a pairing pseudo gap about TC. So I haven't said anything about this. I will say something next. So yeah, go ahead.
Galilean invariance, is that affected by the trap?
Yeah, it is affected by the trap, and you can study it using local density approximations. But
I don't think that's an important point.
So in fact, in the very next slide, I'm going to relax Galilean invariance. I'm also going to see some competing phases, and I'm going to say more about this point.
Maximum PC happens in the PEC side or PC?
So if you ask Matthias, he would say it happens just to the BEC side of the resonance, but it's in very much a fermionic regime, so I have to say that very carefully. If you think about deep in the BEC side, the chemical potential of the constituent fermions has become negative, okay, which is very strange. You have a zero temperature Fermi system in which interactions have driven the chemical potential negative. Okay? So the maximum TC, as best as we know, doesn't happen in that regime. It still happens in a place at a coupling constant where the chemical potential at zero temperature is positive. You have some vestige of Fermi degeneracy present even down to the lowest temperature.
Do you have any parameter we determine different from this crossing of mu zero?
There is. It's just a number. It could have happened at AS equals infinity. It doesn't. It happens to the BEC side of unitarity. Just a number. Okay, so let's take away Galilean invariance and let's see what we get. So right now we don't have experiments on this, but I think experiments on this are going to come. So let's look at the BCS to BEC crossover in an attractive Hubbard model, which is a close cousin of what we've been talking about, except it's a lattice model, and it's not the Hubbard model that everyone wants to study. I have by hand switched the sign of the interaction, so it's the attractive Hubbard model. Okay, so what are the differences of the continuum? So one is that actually at half filling, you get, in addition to a superconducting instability, also charge density wave instability. It seems to complicate things somewhat, and I'm not really going to talk too much about it. But the other very big difference is when you break Galilean invariance, the BEC limit turns out to be very different. Because in the previous case, the mass of the boson was just 2m. Now, it ain't true. In order for a boson to hop, it must first break up and then reconfigure, break up and reconfigure. So the boson hopping matrix element goes like T squared over U. The superfluid stiffness at strong coupling goes like T squared over U. And TC itself goes like T squared over U. So here is a quantum Monte Carlo curve done with various co-workers who were mostly trained by Professor Scalapino in quantum Monte Carlo methods. And you can see that TC goes up, and this is the essential singularity of BCS, and then falls down, and we haven't quite reached a T squared over U regime here. Okay. So on this bigger plot, ignore all the other curves which have nothing to do with this talk, except the red curve is TC going up and coming down. But then there is this pairing scale T star that I'd already talked about where the pairs form. And there is a huge separation between where the pairs form and where they condense. So then you can ask the following question. We understand the crossover in the superfluid state, but what about the normal state, right? Because in the normal, yes, please.
How you got those black points from spin susceptibility or how?
That's right. So how did I get these points and how did I get those? That's a very good question. So this is a two-dimensional simulation. So actually, there is a costless-thouless phase transition. So these are estimates of TC by looking at the universal jump in the superfluid density. So this is coming from a superfluid density calculation. Okay, these points come by looking at the spin susceptibility. Okay, just dmdh, where h couples to n up minus n down, s sub z. Yeah? So what is the point? The point is if you are in a Fermi liquid regime, the spin susceptibility coming down in temperature should be very weakly temperature dependent, Pauli susceptibility. But once pairs form, you're forming singlets, and so the Pauli susceptibility dives down even though you haven't gone through any phase transition. And I'll show you evidence for that.
Now, the question is,
yes.
In these calculations, maximum TC versus hopping is again order of, say, 0.15.
But this is a hopping.
With respect to bandwidth, it will be
down by another factor of 8.
That's 2D systems.
Yeah.
Not 8.
You're right.
Yeah. But that's more or less consistent with what, say, Kigelsang has shown.
This is the same graph he showed.
Same.
Yeah. So he showed our graph.
Okay.
So it had to be
consistent. Again, but it's again, so the bandwidth is the same, almost two orders, many too smaller, yeah?
Yeah. That's true.
And it's still not clear why.
No, this is a quantum Monte Carlo calculation. It gives a number. That's what it is.
But it's, in that sense, it's quite different from Colgate, and it's indeed 0.2, that's actually
that's
almost 1, but
that's correct.
To the minus 2, it's already something.
That's correct.
Okay. Not clear why.
Yeah. So, so here the question one raises is, well, on the BCS side, the normal state is a normal Fermi liquid. On the BEC side, the normal state is a normal Bose liquid. So what if I take a trajectory which never goes superfluid? How do correlation functions cross over from being a normal Fermi liquid to a normal Bose liquid? Now, this question could have had a completely dull answer, namely that you're always at such high temperatures that quantum statistics is not important. But that's not the answer, at least in this two-dimensional model. Okay? What you find is that you find a pairing pseudo-gap in the single particle spectrum and spin correlations. In fact, through the spin susceptibility, we in fact figured out what T star was. And yet, all of this is happening in a highly degenerate Fermi system. So out here, it's not surprising it would happen. But here, you have a very degenerate Fermi system in which pairing correlations give you non-trivial effects. So this is fairly old work, but okay, let's show it anyway. So here is the temperature dependence of the single particle density of states and triangle at the chemical potential and temperature dependence of the spin susceptibility. It's very unusual to find dchi dt positive, okay, flat or Curie tails. On the other hand, if you look at the momentum distribution or the charge compressibility, they are very dull. I mean, they look just Fermi-like. Okay, so now let me switch gears and come to the second half of my talk. Okay, so as I already said, I want to talk about the highest known transition temperature, which is in the cuprates, where you have charged electrons, as opposed to the highest TC over epsilon Fermi, which is in ultra-cold atomic gases with neutral fermions. So these, the cuprates are very different in some respects. You have strongly repulsive interactions at work. You get a D-wave superconductor. The parent systems are Mott insulators, which you have to dope. And in addition to high-temperature superconductivity, there are all sorts of competing orders, such as antiferromagnetism and half-filling, and perhaps stripe-like behavior in many materials. On the other hand, the problem that I have just been discussing has only attractive interactions, has only an S-wave superfluid instability, and that's the only instability in the problem.
If we ask, say, DCSDC in the D-Wave case, would it be a crossover or a phase transition?
No, okay, so we can discuss that. I mean, you could make some fake model where you do that, but I think in general it would be a crossover, but in some cases of non-SA pairing, you get a phase transition also. Okay, and that phase transition has been much more studied in certain other contexts like the P plus IP superconductors and so on than it has been in the D-Wave superconductor. But we can discuss that. Okay, so here is another set of similarities. Both are sort of single band systems. Both are strongly interacting, though in one case repulsion much larger than bandwidth, in another case attraction much larger than bandwidth. Both have small coherence lengths. TC and rho s are in this weird form because in BCS theory, the rho s stiffness scale is much larger than the gap. Not so here, at least on the underdoped side, or here on the BEC side of things. And both have anomalous normal states, so this has much more anomalous normal states. We really do not understand compared to here. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about D-Wave superconductivity in doped MOT insulators. This is work done with many ex-graduate students who have now moved on to greener pastures, and Nandini Trivedi, Fuchen Chang, and some recent work with friends at Bangalore. Okay, so the reason why this problem has, I think, fascinated us for two decades is because it represents the failure of some of the things we teach in textbooks, okay? So first, band theory in a simple form fails for the parent MOT insulator. You need strong interactions to get that. Second, Landau-Fermi liquid theory fails for the strange metal and the pseudo gap, and you don't even fully understand what replaces it, if anything. Okay, and finally, BCS mean field theory at least fails for this D-Wave superconductor, particularly in the strongly underdoped regime. And as if that was not enough, there are all kinds of competing orders, there's very strong disordered inhomogeneity effects, and maybe there are even hidden quantum critical points under the dome which are responsible for the strange metal behavior. We don't know that. So here is the model that a lot of us work with. And I think right up front it should be said that it would be naive to assume that YBCO, LSCO, BISCO, in all their glory, are described by this simple model. It's just a minimal model for the copper-oxygen planes. If we can't understand even this, perhaps we'll be hard-pressed to make progress on more elaborate, more realistic models. But this model I won't tell you much about. I think all of you know what this is. You have hopping on a lattice. Whenever two fermions are on the same site, it costs you a Coulomb energy U, and this is the largest energy scale in the problem. And there's an effective low energy scale generated in the simple Hubbard model, which is the super exchange 4T squared over U, which is an anti-ferromagnetic coupling between electrons on neighboring sites. Now, although I say this is the lowest energy scale in the problem, actually, if you look at transition metal oxides, to get a J of order 100 to 150 millivolts is actually unprecedented. It's a huge J. And we know all of these numbers pretty well from a variety of calculation and experimental techniques. So to the extent that the Coulomb U is the largest energy scale in the problem, you want to work in a Hilbert space in which you prohibit two particles from sitting at the same site, which you implement using a projector, which is like that. So I think all of us agree that the Hubbard model describes the parent antiferromagnetic MOT insulated half-filling. Perhaps not in this audience, but in many other audiences, people are quite concerned about whether the large Hubbard U has anything to do or of any importance in the doped materials. So I wasn't going to say this, but since Mac asked me a question yesterday, I thought I would answer it here. Okay, so how can we answer in as model independent a fashion as we possibly can that the strong Coulomb U is important even in the doped materials? And the answer is, what it leads to is very strong particle hole asymmetry in the spectral function, which you can describe using some exact sum rules for projected electrons. So this is work of ours, which builds on pioneering work of George Savadsky. Okay, and so right now I'm not going to make any assumptions about the ground state, broken symmetries, I'm not even going to assume anything about translational invariance. I'm just going to look at the imaginary part of the retarded Green's function, make some Lehmann representations, and derive some energy integrated sum rules.
Okay.
Yeah.
The question is to this point, actually.
Yeah.
Suppose I consider not really dot multiplier close to Hausdorff, but
yeah,
very low density.
Yeah.
Then I can also make an expansion for summation of letters by gauge parameter.
Indeed.
What is done by
Galitsky and others.
So on, and then,
and by us in two dimensions, actually.
U divided by 1 plus U and X. U effectively separate to something of order of 1. Would you call it still important or not?
So down there,
doesn't depend on the order of limits.
No. So down, so very far from half filling, these effects are very unimportant, and you will see that in the way I derive.
When gas limit, that's indeed not.
That is correct. Yes.
What do you mean by exact sum rules?
I'll tell you after the.
I want to know what.
They are just simply exact. I'm not making any assumptions.
Are you saying you get the exact sum rules when you do projection?
I can tell you exactly what we do, and the answer is yes.
But that's not correct.
Okay, I beg to differ. So, just wait. Okay, so in view of the time, maybe I just simply race through it. But so if I look at the local density of states and integrate it up all the way from negative infinity to the chemical potential, the answer is 1 minus the local whole doping. And this is kind of easy to see intuitively where this comes from, okay, at least in a translationally invariant system. So how many ways can I take an electron out? Well, I can take it out of 1 minus x sites because there are x vacancies. Okay. On the other hand, if I want to add electrons, now I'm adding them, but making sure that I don't do a double occupancy. So I must have an upper cutoff here. Okay. So to leading order, the answer is 2x, because where can I add electrons? Wherever there is a hole. 2 for spin, because I could either add up or down electron. But then there is an order xc over u correction that you can also calculate.
That's not there if you do hard projection.
So, Philip, I think I can very happily sit down with you and tell you what the difference between the TJ model and the repulsive Hubbard model in the large U limit is. But I think that'll just take me away from the main point of my talk.
I just want to ask you a very simple question.
I'll answer it later, Philip.
No, do you believe that if you do projection, that K over U term is there?
I do projection, and then I do a canonical transformation to take me away from the projected limit.
So it's not there if you do projection.
Okay. So let's look at experiments.
Yeah, I have a stupid question.
Sure.
So in the last equation,
yeah,
is that equation valid for TU model, or is it also valid for TT prime U model?
It is also valid for TT prime. It doesn't matter at all. Okay. So this was the reason I did this. Because so what I wanted to say, if Philip would have let me, is that when I go towards the Mach insulator, then there's lots of spectral weight to take out electrons, but very little spectral weight to put in electrons. So at least at the level of sum rules, it's extremely asymmetric. And indeed, that is what the experiments find. And indeed, what they find is as you underdope from pink to green, the asymmetry grows with underdoping. Okay, so I believe this asymmetry actually is in itself a signature of Mach correlations. Now the question is,
I think this is too strong of a statement, but I've been looking at the tunneling data for the barium bismuth oxide class, which let's say negative U for the people who know all the details. There is a kind of asymmetry there too, at least in some of the time.
So I would really like to sit down with you and look at that data.
And I've always felt that's got to be some strong correlation because it's smack dab on the Fermi. But whether it has an origin that is this or like it for the negative view, I don't know. That's an interesting question.
Okay, so good. I'll look at the data with you. I think that's a very important question. Okay, so of course the thing is one would like to really make this quantitative. Right now I've just made a qualitative statement. So we made a proposal, but the proposal, like many theory proposals, is not really, the experiments have not been able to test it in all its glory. So the answer is if I have a tunnel conductance, then I can look at certain ratios of sum rules where matrix elements cancel out. And this business of looking at ratios of things so that matrix elements cancel out has turned our proposal has been very useful, and the STM people are using it on a daily basis. But to test the sum rule, the problem is, how do you integrate down to negative infinity? Okay, so on the negative bias side, what bias do you integrate up to? And so there are some published and some unpublished attempts by Seamus Davis's group. They are tantalizing, but I don't think they are conclusive. Okay, so now back to the main point of what I wanted to talk about. So it seems like a pretty hard task to say that I just take this and out of it comes all that. You know, how is that going to happen? And the answer is, I have no idea how that's going to happen. Okay? So at least the superconducting state is a simple one. Why? It has an order parameter and it has sharp quasi-particles. Unlike these weird states which have no or possibly no order parameter and no sharp quasi-particles. So what strategy would you take to approach the superconductor? Well, you could do diagrams, okay? From the Fermi liquid, look at an instability of the superconductor. The problem is the diagrams are never able to reach this regime. Okay, you could say, look at the instability of the normal state, but I don't understand the normal state, okay? Or I can say, start doping the Mott insulator. But then I need to first cross the antiferromagnet, then cross the stripes, and then get into the superconductor. So what do you do? Well, you say, forget about all those complications and simply use a variational approach to look directly at the zero temperature superconducting state and low-lying excitations. Now, is this an unbiased approach? No, this is a definitely biased approach, okay? So the goal here is not to ask if the 2D Hubbard model has a superconducting ground state. I don't have the tools to answer that. Others might, okay? My goal is to ask, what are the properties of projected wave functions? When I put in strong current in a superconductor, does it look just like a BCS superconductor, or are its properties quite different from that? And how do the properties of projected superconductors compare with the high-temperature superconductors? Okay? Yes.
Are there cases when you can compare the projected wave function to, say, some sort of exact solution?
So I haven't played that game. The reason I haven't played that game is the following, actually. Especially at the very low doping limit, if you look at the comparisons between energies of various states, okay, the energies differences are fractions of J per part. So in other words, I don't even have control over my Hamiltonian at the level of such fine details. So that's why I haven't played too much the game of just trying to find the minimum energy state for a given Hamiltonian. Okay, so the wave function that we're going to look at is just the projected D wave superconductor, where the projection says no double occupancy allowed. And here is the canonical transformation that takes you away from infinite projection and yet allows you to see the Mott insulator at very low dose. Now, in view of the time, maybe I should just simply rush through this. Okay, so this is this also I touched. This is very recent work, and maybe I could have even made a whole talk about it, but I think this is not particularly central to what the point I want to discuss. This is only to say that, look, we can understand antiferromagnetism and superconductivity by putting in band structure effects. We can even understand why antiferromagnetism is stronger on the electron dope side and superconductivity weaker compared to the hole dope side. So at least we have some crude qualitative understanding of the electron hole doping asymmetry in the phase diagram. But right now, since I'm not so bothered about competing phases, I'm going to turn off antiferromagnetism and just focus on superconductivity. Okay, that's for the purposes of this talk. So this has a long history, okay? And there is a sort of amusing review article with Phil Anderson and friends, also which probably non-experts can look at, which describes this. So basically this theory just simply gives you a pairing scale or a gap which goes monotonically with doping, but a superconducting order parameter which shows a dome. more on that very soon. It basically tells you lots of other detailed information about the evolution from a large doping BCS-like state with a Fermi liquid out at even larger dopings, to answer your question. So this theory is not so exotic that it doesn't know about the Fermi liquid that exists out far from where we are interested in. It just gives you that. But there's been a lot of other information we have gotten about the quasi-particles in the superconducting state, what their coherence spectral weight is, what their dispersion is, what the notion of an underlying Fermi surface is, and so on. But let me not talk about that, because here my task was to focus on the robustness of superconductivity. So what I want to do in the next 7 minutes, I don't know how I can do that, is to talk about these things, quantities that I've already talked about. Now, I can't calculate TC at zero temperature. That would be silly of me, wouldn't it? So instead, what I'm going to do is calculate a zero temperature superconducting order parameter, the energy gap, the superfluid thickness, the correlation length. And then at the end, I would like to show some new work, because I think a lot of people in the audience know about this, perhaps not in this setting, on disorder effects. Okay, so energy scales in the superconducting state. So what you can do is you can write down a variational quasi-particle state, a projected Bogliubov quasi-particle. You can compute its gap and ask what its gap does as the maximum gap does as a function of doping, and that's the answer. Okay? And that answer, quite surprisingly, is just uniformly overestimating the experimental gap at the pi zero point by a factor of 2, which for a simple-minded variational calculation of an excited state, I'm not so bothered by. So if I just divide it by a factor of 2, there it is, okay? No fudging of any parameters. Okay, so that's what the gap is doing. And what does the superfluid stiffness do? And the answer is, how do I calculate superfluid stiffness for a ground state wave function? Well, what I actually calculate is an upper bound on the superfluid stiffness, because I do know how to calculate it. It's the Drude weight for the solid state physicists. Okay. And what I find is that that upper bound, which can be written as an equal time correlation function, which I can then calculate in the ground state wave function in two different ways, actually just monotonically decreases. Okay, so upon underdoping, towards the Martens limit, the gap increases, the superfluid density becomes softer and softer. And then when we calculate the off-diagonal long-range order parameter by looking at the C-dagger-C-dagger-C-C correlator at long distances, it shows this dope. So you can see again that on the overdope side of the phase diagram, the increase in the order parameter and the increase of the pairing gap go hand in hand. On the underdope side of the order parameter of the phase diagram, the order parameter dives down, the gap continues up. And the reason that the order parameter dies is because the superfluid density is going up. Another way to say this is, it's the effect of projection. It's not a competing order, which would be a low energy physics on the scale of J, but Coulomb interactions on the very high energy scale of U, which are pushing this order parameter and superfluid density down. Why? Because projection freezes number fluctuations. It doesn't want number to fluctuate. So the conjugate variable is the phase. So the phase fluctuates like mad, okay? And the order parameter dives down.
So in sigma 1, it's pushing oscillator strength way out. That's what you're saying.
That's correct. It need not be way out, but it's taking it out of the delta function is what I'm saying.
Are these calculations done with the e to the is phase factor?
Yes.
So that's putting the number fluctuations back in.
Yes. So you can do it both with and without. Qualitatively, they are the same. I can discuss which quantitative aspects do or do not look different. So none of these look qualitatively different. If I look at the momentum distribution, then that looks quite different whether I do or do not put in the e to the is factor. Okay. So we come to this very strange conclusion again, that superconductivity is most robust near the crossover from pair breaking, where the gap determines superconductivity, and phase fluctuations, where the superfluid stiffness dominates it. Also, for want of time, I'm going to skip this, that there is a sense in which the coherence length is really a minimum near where the order parameter is maximum. But unlike the BCS-BC crossover, which I discussed in the first half of my talk, this is happening as a function of doping. I'm not changing a bare interaction parameter.
You mean the Ginsburg-Landau?
Here?
No, in which?
Yes. Yeah, I will definitely tell you in more detail, Mac, what that coherence length is.
Okay.
Yeah? Yes?
Considering our past way of handling the meetings, I don't think you have to feel tremendous pressure to somehow finish at 10:30.
Okay. Thank you, Doug. But I would prefer not to push the audience into a nonlinear regime. So.
I understand.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
So unlike the BCS-BC crossover, I'm not changing a bare interaction parameter and going from some strong to weak coupling limit. I'm just changing the doping, the carrier concentration in the Hubbard model. The second thing is, yes, the regime near the Mott insulator, okay, where phase fluctuations are very important, is a small pair limit, but it is definitely not bosonic. And this goes back to, I think, something that I was saying again, that if I look at the chemical potential, I have a highly degenerate Fermi system. Okay, so it's not some Bose condensation. That would be a very poor choice of words to describe what's going on there. Yes, Philip.
So you're getting turn on of superconductivity right when you go from x equals 0.
No, so that I have to go back and show you antiferromagnetism intervening. And I had put down...
this calculation doesn't have that.
This calculation, I'm taking it out because I want to just tell you what superconductivity is doing, but I can go back and show you other places where I put in antiferromagnetism, seeing that it definitely takes over. But even when we find antiferromagnetism, we find coexistence of antiferromagnetism and superconductivity in the very low doping regime, quite similar to Mark and Gabby Cartlier's results. Whereas truth in advertising, I don't think there is that much evidence for coexistence of antiferromagnetism and superconductivity in the cube grains.
Now, does the antiferromagnetic boundary depend on the phase, on this number, on the EPIS factor?
The antiferromagnetic boundary, I do not know if it depends. We have not tested that. We have only done the antiferromagnet for the TT prime, T double prime J model. So there was no E to the IS factor there. Okay. It does depend very strongly on T prime and T double prime.
Yeah. So to get the antiferromagnet, are you projecting the antiferromagnet? Are you starting with still D-wave superconductor wave function and
make... Okay, so that's a very good question. To get antiferromagnetic long-range order, I actually have to allow the wave function to know about antiferromagnetic long-range order. You could ask the question, suppose I didn't tell the wave function about it, does it find out about it? And the answer is it almost finds out about it. So if I look at this point in this calculation, it's actually an algebraic spin liquid, okay? But with a decay of antiferromagnetic correlations, which is sort of a non-integrable power law. I can show you that. So yes, this is smart enough to know that I should be doing something down there, but obviously not to produce it for me.
In which sense, actually, it's not really good to speak about preformed pairs and thermodynamics.
So all I said was that...
Still, very large fraction of the whole thermal surface is involved in pairs.
This is
in
true.
Compared to normal BCS.
This is absolutely pair. True.
So
this is
language is really not appropriate.
So all I say is that it's a degenerate Fermi system. And by that, I mean the following. If you go to the BCS-BEC crossover problem, and you really go deep into the BEC regime, then it's so bosonic in nature that the chemical potential of the fermions is negative even at zero temperature. Negative meaning below the bottom of the band.
So you are still in a crossover regime, but maybe already on both part of it.
That may be a reason. Okay. So I'll take 5 minutes since I am... So disorder effects in correlated superconductors. So now if you're one of the ADS CFT types, you say you have something clean, why muck it up, okay? But actually, there's a whole history of studying disorder in superconductors. It's a very important question because the robustness of superconductivity is somehow tested by this disorder. And when superconductivity arises from a repulsive interaction, as it does here, then it's very likely going to be unconventional. By unconventional, the technical meaning is breaking a symmetry other than U1. Okay. So in the cuprates, it's D-wave. Okay. And the standard theory, which goes back to Abrikosov and Gorkov in the 1950s, says that if you put in disorder into a D-wave superconductor, it should destroy the pairing. Okay. And in fact, this was probably the reason why people like Doug had to face a lot of criticism in almost the first 6 or 7 years of high temperature superconductivity, where nobody would believe that this was a D-wave superconductor.
I remember at almost the first meeting, it must have been in July after the discovery was over in Trieste, Abrikosov was there. And I remember his first question after my talk was the pair breaking.
Right.
And it was clearly true that pair breaking was something that made you think that D-wave would have extremely difficult.
Right. And so I think now we learn if we want the large Coulomb scale to give us high temperature superconductivity, it would seem we will always have to ask the question, why doesn't pair breaking kill us?
Yeah, but pair breaking works only normal BCS.
Yeah, like so I would like to give my version of that.
Like pair doesn't break.
Okay. So
you need to include this don't break pairs even in normal BCS.
I'll show you Born. I'll show you Born. I know. Yes, this theory has its origin in Russia and.
You only have to worry about that.
Yeah, you don't need to. Okay, so why are these materials so robust against disorder? That's a. One reason that we have understood is that the intrinsic disorder lies off the copper-oxygen plane. You can actually go and put in a zinc impurgon copper-site, but otherwise, if you make a material, the disorder, the copper-oxygen planes are very robust. Poor choice of words.
Never mind.
Okay, but you know what I mean. Yeah. Okay. Then the second thing is that the coherence length is very short, and actually that's a very important point because you get a very spatially inhomogeneous response to impurities. You put in an impurity, it does something bad in its neighborhood, and on a short distance scale, superconductivity is up and running. Okay? But what we found in this very recent paper, and which we are only beginning to come to grips with, is that actually disorder effects are very strongly suppressed in a strongly correlated superconductor. So let me give you the evidence for that. First of all, what do we do? Okay. So we absolutely must take into account the inhomogeneous response to impurity. So we do what to my solid state friends, they all know it, Bogliubov-Duchenne theory. Okay, so how do we deal with correlation effects? And now we do something very approximate. It's an approximation that has been tested in the uniform case against variational Monte Carlo and so on. But in any case, what we do is what is called the Goetz-Wheeler approximation. And now in the calculation, we can compare the results with and without correlations. You can't turn off correlations in the real systems. They are not an optional extra. In fact, the disorder might be thought of as an optional extra. Okay, so here's what we find.
What do you mean without correlations? What is the superconductor in the absence of correlations? Okay. It's the correlations that are driving this.
Yes, so this is the calculation that people have been doing for the last 15 years, okay? What they do is they don't put in any projection, they don't put in any no double occupancy. All they say is that let me have a nearest neighbor attraction scale which is set by J, which is going to give me a D wave, and let me do a Bogliubov-Duchenne calculation. So lots of us, Peter Hirschfield, myself included, we've all been guilty of doing that, okay? Right. Okay, so this is ignoring correlations, that's including correlations. So one thing that you immediately see, so this is showing the local D-wave pairing amplitude response to Born impurities, and the parameters of the two calculations are chosen such that the pristine system would have the same D-wave pairing. So that's a reasonable way to compare the two. Okay, and you see a much shorter healing length in the correlated system. You can just simply see that from these pictures. And the reason for this is at least threefold as far as we can see from this numerical calculation. One is, of course, in any correlation length, there's a VF in the numerator. And that, or M star, gets renormalized by correlation. So VF is brought down, correlation length comes down. The second is that interactions tend to screen the potential, as it were. Okay? And the third thing, which is also very important, is if we switch off these local changes in hopping, we do not see this. So the fact that you have local density variations around an impurity site, that impact the local hopping matrix element through the Goodswiller approximation is crucial to this physics. So, but this is not an observable. What kinds of effects does it have on observable properties? So here is one, okay? So this is the density of states, okay, in the Bevilacqua division with correlations and Bevilacqua division without correlations. It's color-coded according to density of impurities. And what you find is something which surprised us, that the low-energy nodal quasi-particles are completely unaffected by disorder in this calculation if you put correlations in. Only the antinodal regions are affected. If you don't put the correlations in, the entire density of states is affected.
Shouldn't you be developing something like zero bias peak from your individual?
So this is because it's born impurity, we don't get zero bias peak. We would get some density of states here, and this is the density of states at omega equals zero, so I've taken some very small interval and averaged it over. And you can see, so if you do simple T matrix, you get a very large density of states. If you do Bogliobov Dejean, you get a much smaller density of states. If you do Bogliobov Dejean plus correlation, you get an even smaller density of states.
But I mean, just naively looking at your picture,
yes,
your slide, would you think that you should rather treat these impurities as unitary impurities and not born impurities?
No. Because neither the parameters are born-like, and the previous slide is just simply saying...
So they kept weak, but just becomes shorter range.
That's right. Okay, and so here is data from Seamus Davis's group. And again, this says that if I look at things in a highly disordered environment, the low energy V is untouched by disorder. You can see this from various other conductance maps and so on. Whereas the antinodal regions are very strongly impacted by disorder. Okay, so I think since I've gone 10 minutes over, I will not discuss this in any detail. You can ask where do these low energy excitations near the node live, and the nodes seem to be protected. And in general, the nodal quasi-particle spectral function is much less affected by disorder than the antinodal one. So that's my concluding slide. So what I've done is in two very different situations, the first being, oh, and the second one should have been 2, but since it was being written at 2 a.m., okay, so in the first situation, S-wave pairing in the BCS-BEC crossover is a function of interactions, and the second situation being D-wave pairing in cuprates as a function of doping. You see that superconductivity is most robust near this crossover from pair breaking scale set by delta to phase fluctuations set by rho S, and where the coherence length is a minimum. In both cases, you seem to get a pairing pseudo gap when delta is greater than rho S, although in the case of cuprates, this is only part of a much more complicated story because you have Mach physics and competing orders also playing in there. And I think even though the superconducting state in the cuprates is, in my opinion, at least reasonably well understood, the strongly correlated normal states and the breakdown of Fermi liquid theory are very poorly understood at the present time. Thank you.
About the disorder, if you photo copper with something else, that really destroys superconductivity in cuprates, right?
So you want to put zinc, for instance?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it does, but actually I think it's still the way in which it destroys superconductivity. I'm making an experimental statement. Is not as much as you might have expected from conventional theories.
That's right.
Of course it will, eventually. And we haven't studied that.
You only say it's not ever across the core cup.
That's right.
I'm not sure that you're saying it's not a big deal. Do you understand correctly? What you're actually saying is that there are two effects which essentially reduce the recursive going of parameter. One is that Fermi velocity gets normalized, and the second is that you have additional screening because of correlation effects. But after that, it's just plain a Bilkov theory, which also, as a matter of fact, doesn't change the density of states below some limit.
No, so Bilkov assumes that your superconducting order parameter is homogeneous in space. That's just inbuilt into that theory. Whereas we know, both from calculations and even more importantly from experiments, that the response to impurities is highly inhomogeneous. So it cannot be simply a precursor.
So your main conclusion, you just say that discrete superconductivity is fine, but you actually, don't touch the question of the mechanism.
Okay, I can ask a mechanism question. I didn't show that. I could ask, okay, in a variational wave function, what is lowering the energy over this very large range of dopings? Forget the very low antiferromagnetism region. Okay, so I could, for instance, look at the energy differences between a projected superconductor and a projected Fermi liquid. And the answer is exactly the answer that Doug gives. It's the exchange energy which is gained. So it's J which is driving the pairing here. Does that answer the question of mechanism? I don't know. That depends on how you pose that question, I guess.
I was just looking at your impurity density of states results. It looks right. Like the asymmetry in the case with no correlation is about the same as...
Okay, so actually you're perceptive, and I also said that somewhere, that I'm only plotting the coherent Bogliubo quasi-particle contribution. Oh. So I'm not plotting the incoherent part, which has all the asymmetry. Yes, Doug.
Maybe with respect to your discussion yesterday of what Ali Yazdani has shown us, is the students somehow well up above TC can spot regions that are then mapped out when you finally go superconducting. You've shown us that both there can be a gap and there can be a low S. Can you understand, do you understand those experiments within this framework?
No, because all the calculations I have done are zero temperature calculations. And you're asking me a very interesting high temperature question. The variational method is very ill-suited to answer such a question. Philip?
I just want to ask a question about your statement that the superconducting state is relatively well understood. Optical conductivity data by Van der Marl's group and Bontemps' group show very clearly that to recover the delta function weight at omega equals zero, you have to integrate the optical conductivity out to 2 electron volts.
Okay.
How does this come out of your...
I cannot calculate the optical conductivity by knowing the ground state wave function. I can calculate some rules in the optical conductivity. So if I look at the only...
You find that the superfluid density depends on the high energy scale?
So I can calculate the optical plasma frequency, and I can compare it with all the results that are out there in the literature, and for whatever it is worth, the agreement is very sensible. But that's a very gross statement. It's not a statement at the level at which you're asking me, you know.
Right.
Where is spectral weight moving when some phase transition occurs? I'm simply saying if I integrate everything up, I know how much there is.
These experiments are very specific, that especially the Van der Marl one, that the intraband spectral weight increases in lieu of a decrease of the interband spectral weight the moment you go through the superconducting transition. So it seems as if any sort of statement about mechanisms or calculations of the superconducting state have to at least explain that.
Uh, Okay, so I didn't say that I wanted to answer the mechanism question, nor did I want to say that I want to answer specifically detailed questions about spectral wave transfers going from the normal to the superconducting state, unless we understand the normal state, you cannot answer that question. That's all. Come back.
So, actually, I have another question. So, I could have thought about slightly different variation waveforms.
Yes.
Instead of doing a full projection.
Yes.
Then I'm willing to do a partial projection.
Yes.
One minus G.
Yes.
And I have an iron down.
Yes.
And I can imagine that G changes as a function of doping.
Yes.
So, do you think that the full projection is the better way to go?
So here is my perspective on that. So what I do is a full projection and then do this cone, Rice, Gross joint canonical transform.
You're just transforming your operators.
I'm transforming every operator, if you wish. But instead of doing it in a sort of, it depends. In a Heisenberg-like representation, I would say I'm transforming operators. In a Schrodinger-like representation, I just put it on my wave function. And that's what I'm doing. Okay, so what are the pros and cons of backing off a full projection using the canonical transformation versus what you say? If I do what you say, I don't recover the Mott insulator at half filling.
But if G equals to 1 at the half filling?
But it doesn't. If I just use that as a variational parameter, it doesn't do that.
I see.
And so I would prefer to recover the Mott insulator at half filling than not.
So you're saying if you let this parameter G to be a variational parameter.
Yes.
And do the calculation, the G doesn't become 1 at the half filling?
That's correct. Yeah.
There are calculations like that that do get the Mott insulator with partial projection, but what they have to do is they have to put in binding between doublons and the holons.
That's correct.
Calculations by Gross.
That is correct.
So
I would just like to do the simplest thing I can do, which gives me a...
Which is why it's crucial that to get to understand your antiferromagnet that you really understand the role of E to the IS. But that's putting in the number of fluctuations which are going to fight against the antiferromagnet.
I don't believe that at half filling at all, the statement you made. Away from half filling, I don't know the answer.
Like, epigenetic question on this sort of disorder and what you're seeing there.
So, yes.
So I think if you had very weak impurities, we agree that the weak coupling picture should survive with the normalized parameters. So for a very weak impurity, you're bound to get apical of style results, but with the normalized parameters. Yeah? But so my question now is...
I'm not sure that I know that that's true. But okay, suppose I...
Your results are going to be the same.
I know it's very inhomogeneous.
That's what's my point.
Yeah, please.
So I think when there are very big impurities, and it's clear, know that there's an effective Lorentz description in terms of the quasi particles in the D-wave superconductor, so we are bound to get this effective description of the normalized parameter. But now when you say it's very inhomogeneous, I think that translates to the fact that the impurities are not weak. So my question is more or less, I was saying that correlation, so that you could think of two effects. You could say, oh, correlations can normalize stuff that impurities are less important. Or you could say, oh, correlations make impurities more important, and therefore I go in a completely different regime. I think probably the second picture is more correct, that you say impurities make more correlation, correlation make impurities stronger effectively.
Look, if correlation made if strong, if I use those words, I conjure up the image that the high temperature superconductors would be extremely susceptible to disorder, which is exactly the opposite of what happens and exactly the opposite of the image that I would like to.
As you explained very clearly, there are different scales in the problem.
That's true.
There's coherence and there's gap, and so stronger and weaker have to kind of, they have different meaning depending on what scale you look at.
That's true. So actually we have not investigated this taking into account various scales, taking impurity strengths across various scales. This is just the first salvo in this.
I very much agree with what, you know, I think if you want to understand, rationalize your result, not question your result, that it looks like you should be able to rationalize this result somewhere on a scale between fully unitary and fully born scattering in our conventional understanding.
That is work in progress. So we are trying to do that.
I mean, you know, there is in principle there is full generalization of the classical theory for on any intermediate regime by Prevost and Musicar and the things. So you can just, these analytical formulas, which you can just...
The point is, Igor, those analytical formulas are all derived in the limit in which Kf C0 is much, much greater than 1.
No, I don't think so. I don't think there is.
It's all quasi-classical approximations.
Not a fully unitary regime, or maybe that's right. But let me just go on with it. You get this result which believe is correct and it explains this particular thing. But I think the problem is disorder in superconductors is more general than that. You know, you can go, in some sense, the initial response to these questions, why deep wave parent is not broken, is it because TC is so high that that continuous length is very small. But at the same time, we now know that impurities are actually not very effective. Even low temperature superconductors, superconductors are not very sensitive.
Which one do you have in mind there?
No, even non-2-cuprofor is not, but apparently you can,
the 2-1-4 strontium ruthenate certainly.
That's right, strontium ruthenate is an unconventional superconductor.
But still, it's the same.
Yeah. Or heavy fermions also.
Or even such elementary thing as niobium diselenide, which is a two-gap superconductor, which on the level of Bregozov Volkov theory, for weak scattering should be just exactly linearly dependent as D-wave. And it's not. And it's very, very low temperature superconductor.
So I have nothing to say about two-band superconductors.
No, but this is mathematically, it's just the same thing. You know, who cares whether you have some part of emissors negative, some positive. What you care is they're different.
Yeah.
So there's something more general in these old things.
On that note, I think we should break because there will be a discussion. I believe, actually, I would like the discussion.
In this room?
No. No, it's in the founder's room at 11 o'clock.
Led by the gentleman who's keeping us.
This is wrong.